Why do some patients respond to immunotherapy while others don't? The answer may lie in how tumors create environments that suppress immune responses. Dr. Roberta Zappasotti joined the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy Network as a Parker Scholar in 2016. Now, as an assistant professor of hematology and medical oncology at Weill Cornell Medicine, a Parker Bridge Fellow, and a member of Cornell's newly established Pisces Center, she studies how tumors alter their metabolism and blood vessel formation to resist treatment, and how this knowledge could lead to better therapies. I'm Dr. Shane Corcoran from Pisces. Today on From Bench to Fireside, Pisces Chief Scientific Officer Dr. John Connolly speaks with Dr. Zappasotti about her cutting-edge research at the intersection of immunology, metabolism, and tumor biology. They discuss how her work is revealing new strategies to improve cancer treatments and the role of collaboration in accelerating scientific discovery. You'll also hear how the Pisces Network brings together experts from diverse fields from the world's leading research institutions to drive breakthroughs to turn all cancers into curable diseases. Join us as we explore the science that powers immunotherapy on From Bench to Fireside.
Hi, I'm John Connolly, the Chief Scientific Officer of the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Roberta Zappasotti, who is, you know, just been part of the Parker Institute since the very beginning. You know, Roberta, your involvement spanned multiple institutions across Pisces, and really, thankfully, much of your career associated with us. You're an assistant professor of hematology and medicine in the Division of Hematology and Medical Oncology at Weill Cornell School of Medicine, a faculty member of immunology and microbial pathogenesis programs in the Weill Cornell Graduate School, and you hold the E. Lippmann J.J. McCarthy Research Scholar position at breast cancer at Weill Cornell. Thankfully, you've been part of Pisces for quite a while, so you're a recipient of Pisces Parker Scholarship Award in 2016 for your postdoctoral training, and then just a great award, the 2019 Parker Bridge Fellowship as well. So it's just wonderful to see you again and to catch up.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. It has been wonderful to, you know, working with you for so long and be introduced to science, to the top science since the very beginning. So that's really invaluable.
Your work has just been fantastic, and it's really guided the way in areas, particularly identifying markers of predictive response in immunotherapy, where you've done some incredible work identifying mechanisms of resistance to cancer immunotherapy, uncovering whole new areas that we'll dive into, both in cellular responses, but also in the deep metabolic responses that mm-hmm. underpin that resistance. So it's great. So how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, hearing amazing science and having some confirmatory chat with colleagues about the work that we are doing. And, you know, as you said, we have been and continue to do work on the biomarker space. Although the strategy that I try to follow all along is really to utilize, clinical drugs, also to understand basic mechanisms of the, of how the immune system fights cancer. And I that is also the recipe of my group and my emerging team, right? Because we need to be successful. And in order to make impactful work, we want to be somehow related to the clinic, but also, being able and positioned to, make new discoveries. And I do feel that, leveraging immunotherapy drugs and approaches to also understand basic mechanism of anti-tumor immunity is really what, I like to do. And that's, where I come from, essentially.
Absolutely. And I think that your work has always been at that interface between the fundamental science and translating that into the clinic. And in doing so, you've really pioneered a lot of the work in just this translational medicine work, where it's really experimental medicine. You're deep looking at clinical samples and relating that back to models, but it's really the fundamental work in human immunology that's guided a lot of the great discoveries that you and your colleagues and teammates and the entire group has pushed forward. So you start out in an incredibly awesome area of training in Milan. So
yes.
Just a wonderful university with some just incredible people there.
Yeah.
A really hotspot of immunology in Europe. So what is it that led you to take that and move to the US and to dive into your training?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I train in Milan, and actually did my PhD work at the National Cancer Institute of Milan, which has the oldest archive of human tumor specimens.
That's amazing.
And you know, that's where my human translational work comes from. And so, you know, my time there was between 2006 and 2012. And I was already doing immunotherapy, but of course that was very pioneering work, you know, and I had a very rounded exposure to preparing vaccines from tumor samples, starting in lymphoma, and then applied some of those concepts in ovarian cancer, although that work was not published, didn't make it, but actually it was a good experience for me. And also expanding T cells in the lab, because our idea was to combine an active immunization with the harvesting of T cells from the same patients, expand them and then reinfuse. And so in a way, I was exposed to many of the current immunotherapies that, you know, now have made it, you know, to the clinic. And of course, there is room for improvement, but now we are in a much better situation for doing that work. My mentor at the time was a medical doctor. And so I think that really since the very beginning, I needed to learn how to interact with clinicians. And, you know, I used to go to the surgery room to collect specimens. And, you know, the funny part is that one of the reasons why I didn't embark in, you know, becoming a doctor was that I'm a vagal. But my clinician colleagues knew. And so they would call me to the surgery room since the very beginning of the intervention. They wanted to challenge me. And maybe now in retrospect, I could do both. But really, I started in a translational space for immunotherapy before immunotherapy was really formally proved to be able to fight cancer. I had to say, after 7 years there doing my PhD, we published well. However, my you know, the reason for me to move and to do more mechanistic study was really because of, you know, the limitation of what you can do in human, right? So in human, you can correlate immune changes or molecular changes with a response to treatment, but you know, you will never know if that was a real cause. And so, really, that was really my motivation to combine more basic science with maybe confirmatory correlative studies in human. And I had a great opportunity to join, you know, Dr. Jed Wolchok and Taha Mergubat Memorial at the time for my postdoc, and that was an incredible opportunity to really bridge these two scientific needs, you know, at the bottom of my heart.
Absolutely. Memorial, you know, going from one legendary center, Milano, to really the heart of immunotherapy and the history of immunotherapy at Memorial Sloan Kettering, just seemed really incredible. And so what was it that brought you to that lab? And what was it? What was the big differences you saw in the two institutions?
Yeah, I would say that I was a hard worker in Milan already. Sure. But I felt that here you know, you could perhaps utilize the same number of hours per day in the lab, but the time dedicated to research was better spent. So we were given time to study and think and design experiments. So, or maybe it was also, who knows, right? I'm a scientist, so I don't know if it was the environment or me growing as a scientist, right? But certainly my mentors give us space to think and protected us from the pressure, really promoting our creativity. And that's what really I appreciated.
Yeah, absolutely. And so is that something you've taken now? So now you've transitioned to your position at Cornell. And is that something you've taken in balancing your work as a scientist and as a mentor?
Yeah, I try to do that as much as I can. Of course, the pressure of being a junior faculty is high, right? Yeah, because sure. we need to make it in order to maintain our territory and expand and bring more people, increase the team. So, and everyone is on board and aware of that pressure. But I really try to cultivate their passion and their creativity. And that is basically, I think, a key ingredient for that is really following their data and reconcile what they find so that it's not too much you like leading their work, but there is a strong component of how they think and how they would direct the work. And of course, the amount of guidance that I need to give to trainees depends on the level, right? So graduate students may need more guidance than postdoc, but whenever there is a good idea that comes from them, I really push for that and they own it, and that's make it work.
Well, I mean, the challenges that are in front of all of us, particularly in the cancer immunotherapy space, are huge. What do you think the biggest hurdles are now in tackling immunotherapy?
Yeah, I think, this is an amazing momentum to really do comprehensive studies.
Sure.
And unbiased studies, because we have unprecedented capacity to analyze tissue or whatever specimen at very deep resolution. I think the big caveat still is that, that is a single time point and a single piece of tissue. And so we also understand that there is huge heterogeneity in a single tumor and within each patient. And so I wish we could better understand the status overall of a patient to really understand what's going on. So I do feel that there is really amazing potential to go very into maximal details, maximum molecular details. I hope that we keep thinking about the drawback of that, of losing the big picture. And so I think the two parts need to be brought along together.
No, it's a great point. You know, when you think about the differences between the mouse models that we use in the lab, to identify, and rightly so, some really fundamental immunology associated with response, there's just no parallel to that between a patient walking in who's gone through tons of different kind of cancer care and maybe have had a tumor for years that's been immunoselected. It's just a completely different, it's a huge disconnect, and it's a big challenge, no doubt about it. So yeah. How is it that, your work, your deep molecular work, and particularly looking at that tumor microenvironment, looking at the arrangement of those cells, how is that taking us a step closer to curing cancer?
Yeah, so I had to say, again, I was lucky to be working with colleagues in imaging and radiology and metabolism world, which really brought me into opening part of my program in that area and really thinking more about the physics of the immune system with respect to, fluidics and how the cells are going into the tumor, right? And I honestly, when I started to realize that, I also felt a bit dumb that I didn't think about that earlier on in my career. But so now, bringing those principles in my, deep core immunology work, I really try to connect those points and really understand, how the T cells traffic to the tumor through the vasculature and the impact of local metabolites in affecting that function that we want to improve in T cells to, in their fights against cancer. And so that's where we are going right now, really trying to figure out how really the T cells interact with the vasculature and make them better trafficker into the tumor. Zooming a bit out, also considering what I just said before, about having more dynamic measurements, I'm learning more and more about, what we can do imaging wise. And again, here I need to build collaborations, of course, in order to learn and go faster and reaching the point that we want faster. But radiologists and imaging people are excited about collaborating with immunologists. And sometimes I'm also excited to talk about my work with my father, who is a radiologist. And so I guess, I keep saying him, imaging, perhaps you did the right choice, Dad. and maybe then that will be we should leverage, those approaches better to study really the dynamic of an immune response, for example, but maybe even other things. But of course, we do immunotherapy, so that's what we want to see.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it seems like you really are addressing key areas, with trafficking and looking at intravitally. This is really where you're actually seeing the activity happen. And you touched a little bit about metabolism playing a key role in this. Could you maybe talk a little bit about one of the fundamental difference between, say, a tumor and normal tissue is the metabolic differences between these two. So maybe touch on that and how it influences trafficking and response.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I realize that perhaps the connection between tumor metabolism and vasculature and T cells is a bit, unknown, and is basically where we are working right now. And I can give you a little bit of a broader context about that. And actually, the interest in going into the vasculature and interaction between T cells and vessel cells really comes and stems from really understanding how tumor metabolic preferences change the microenvironment. And so we really started off by studying in the lab, in animal models, tumors that we perturb in order to have different glycolytic potential. And so they eat more or less glucose, they produce ATP from glycolysis more so than oxidative phosphorylation. And so by really comparing and contrasting those tumor microenvironment, the first things was maybe, as we could imagine, a difference in T cell abundance. Of course, if the tumors are metabolically impaired, T cells live a happier life in that otherwise very harsh microenvironment. Of course, both T cells and the tumor cells need nutrients, and we can say that perhaps our immune system can go as fast as the tumor cells in proliferating, but they need that energy. And tumor cells learn much better throughout a longer period of time how to adapt and utilize the nutrient that they find. But another very peculiar aspect that we saw change, depending on, again, this tumor glycolytic state, was really the structure and phenotype of the vasculature. And again, we are trying to figure out whether, you know, the role of the vasculature versus the nutrients availability in the tumor microenvironment in dictating this differential T cell recruitment and function. Perhaps it's both, right? Yeah. Because the T cells need to go in there first, and then whatever they find may help them engage in their function. But yeah, so that is basically where we started to look at the vasculature and really learning vasculature biology again, and thinking also about, for example, how local metabolites can alter, you know, blood flow through the vasculature. You can imagine NO is important for the muscle function around the vasculature to promote and pump. And so, yeah, we need to understand better physiologically how, you know, the immune response is elicited and mounted and can be sustained. And I really like, you know, this connection. I mean, we stumble on it and I really like it, so.
Oh, it's fantastic. And as I said, it addresses the first key issue. It doesn't matter how good the T cells are if they can't get there.
Yeah.
You know, if they can't get to the tumor,
right,
especially do their job.
Yeah.
So, and we see this a lot, just even in synthetic biology, as you know, like in the CAR T space and others, where there you've got these sort of barriers, you know, and sometimes they're stromal, but a lot of times it is hydrodynamic and it's vasculature, as you talked about, that are preventing proper penetration of the tumor. And so it's just like completely different worlds, fully armored cells that are ready to go to kill.
Yeah.
And right next to them is their target and they just can't get there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so metabolism being central in that just makes a huge amount of sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also see that the, you know, the field is going there, you know, again, coming back from CT, there was a whole session about vasculature in antitumor immunity. So I think we are on topic.
Coming back from SITC, you know, such a really a premier meeting for cancer immunotherapy. What did you see as kind of the themes that are coming out of this? And how did your work and the work of the field really pushing things forward? Where are we going to be in a couple of years?
Yeah, well, I saw many points that we are trying also to study in the lab. And again, this may be also based on the talks that I selected to, to hear. Yeah, of course, a predominant theme was about T cell therapy. And I think there is a lot to do there and a lot of potential. Again, harming those T cells to traffic better or to eat alternative sources, going back to the vasculature and the metabolites. I feel that T cell therapy will advance as well as perhaps smaller molecules that can achieve similar effects, for example, antibody drug conjugates. And so I do see that those two areas are moving quite at the same speed. And perhaps you cannot get to produce those T cells for certain patients. And so you need to have a faster off-the-shelf strategy. And so I feel that is a good compromise. And there is a lot to study also in terms of mechanism of action, depending on the payload, in how you reshape the microenvironment, you make vaccines, you know, you modulate the tumor microenvironment to behave like a vaccine. I think it's a very interesting momentum now to see how immunotherapy is going earlier on in the lines of treatment. And so there is, you know, better opportunity to treat those patients just harming their own immune system. And so all these new adjuvant trials are fantastic.
You know, one of the things that you mentioned and is just the technological advances in different fields, whether it's spatial transcriptomics or it's intravital imaging or you name it. It guides, you know, the way you look at your own work and the opportunities. You mentioned ADCs is such a rush in the field, both in pharma, biotech, and even in academia, developing new antibody drug conjugates to increase the local concentration. And I'm wondering whether or not this is an opportunity, you know, with some of these drugs, particularly targeting core metabolic pathways, where it's actually difficult to systemically administer these drugs, you know, because all your cells, including your brain, really needs a lot of nutrients and these pathways to function properly, where this might be an opportunity to selectively begin to target these drugs more selectively for combinations, you know, with the discoveries you and your lab are making.
Yeah. So I do feel also that another pressing question that has been around for a while is, you know, how to combine logically and in a clever way what we have right now, because now we have chemo, radiation, targeted therapy, ADC, and other stuff. And so I do feel that we need to improve there, and perhaps, you know, AI can help us in that direction to, you know, assess those features in a more comprehensive way and in a way that we can test these things. Going back to your question about, I mean, ADC, I think is an amazing tool. I wish we could do more, you know, work with those agents in syngeneic mouse models. I think, you know, you said a very on, you know, specific word, like these are really rushed into the clinic, and similar things were done with CAR T, right? Where of course you want to have a clinically relevant product. And so you make those CAR T with a human construct that targets a human, target on the tumor cells. I think that, you know, as these drugs are rushing in pharma and in the clinic, we have an important, you know, work to accomplish in the lab and in academia to take a step back and, you know, study those agents in syngeneic animals, because at the end of the day, we need to also awaken the, you know, endogenous T cell response, because of course, targeting a single target will not be sufficient. And so the only way to see which combination, which timing, which schedules can achieve that is really to, you know, study those agents in immunocompetent animal. Yeah. And so I hope there will be, you know, an increasing partnership between pharma and academia to do those type of work as these drugs are tested in maybe earlier phase clinical trials in human. But I do feel that the next step to guide really combination is to take a step back and do more preclinical work.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think, you know, the shame is not to rush it into the clinic, because the need is so desperate. You could see why someone would want to do that. Yeah. It's just that when the results of that kind of ill-informed clinical trial are negative, they kill the programs. It's just like, guys, no, you need to iterate back, and we need to kind of take it back and figure out why it didn't work and get to the heart of it. You know, this is, it's still a huge opportunity though that's out there. You know, one of the things you did mention, I think that is the availability of models. So one of the problems in the field, particularly in these targeted therapies, maybe MHC restricted therapies, human specific, is that we really don't have great surrogate models that'll predict particularly toxicity, you know, for some of the therapies. How do you feel about your work and trying to guide the development of models that better match the real tumor microenvironment?
I mean, a model is a model, right? So you always compromise. And we have seen amazing success with drugs that were used in, you know, not super perfect animal models, including CAR T, xenograft, and immune checkpoint blockade in maybe immunogenic tumor context. And so I do feel that we need to realize that. How we try to improve over that. So in my lab, we're trying to be a little bit ambitious. And so I not only work in the solid cancer space, but I also look back to my Italian experience in B-cell lymphoma and to really comparing and contrasting the efficacy or lack of efficacy of T-cell therapy and immune checkpoint blockade therapy in these two type of scenarios. And And what you said, the lack of preclinical animal models is very true, especially for heme malignancies. And that was also a caveat, you know, what I said in the beginning, that a caveat I perceived studying immunotherapy in Milan was that we actually were limited in studying those features in a correlative way in human because of the lack of lymphoma models, essentially. And so I really, you know, a reason why I joined Cornell is because here there is a very strong lymphoma program. And here there are pioneering lab really developing genetically engineered mouse models that develop B-cell lymphomas based on the certain mix of genetic lesions that are usually found in human B-cell lymphoma.
That's
so
great.
We can reproduce the genetic heterogeneity of those tumors. And so a key question is whether these, depending on these driver mutations, whether we achieve a different microenvironment and which drug we need to give in those specific microenvironments. So of course, you know, working in spontaneous models takes longer.
Yeah.
But I think we have no other way
in order
to improve immunotherapy in these specific diseases that really are diseases of the immune system itself. So, you know, it's more complicated there.
I think, you know, the other part of the deep analysis that you do is you're able to really see that heterogeneity in patient populations. And so how does that research really lend itself to biomarker discovery and how are you seeing those biomarkers applied to clinical trial design?
Well, B-cell lymphomas are super highly heterogeneous in patients, and we know that. In spontaneous models, we do see heterogeneity as well. You know, the hope is that we can see maybe a strong signal among this heterogeneity that can guide our primary target. And then we'll see what follows and we can modulate other things. And again, this goes back to the question of how to combine things and what to expect to certain drugs, right? Many drugs that target immune pathways or metabolic pathways or vasculature pathway are modulators. And so perhaps we should not expect single agent activity,
but
we need to figure out the biology in order to understand when together these drugs can lead to tumor clearance.
Yeah. And the other aspect of that is just understanding, you know, that what the final goal is. You know, you mentioned single agent activity is great, but we really want to actually start not just a immune targeted single target kind of going after it, but initiate the actual immune system, you know, which is multicellular, dynamic, and responsive to get things done. So how is it that you're thinking moving from something like a single checkpoint or, a vaccine or something like that, they could really engage this entire system? How do you see the deeper understanding get us that one step closer to
So I do feel that learning the biology of these molecules is important. And I can make you an example of, you know, we published this Nature Medicine paper in 2019 about the biological activity of a GITR agonist antibody. And so that agent did not really have, or maybe a slight, you know, the single agent activity was low. However, we did see consistent biologic activity in terms of, you know, reduction of certain immune suppressive regulatory T cells. Mm-hmm. And so based on that, of course, we cannot expect that just decreasing the breaks can unleash T cell response to cancer. And so we, you know, designed this experiment in mice where we combined that agent with PD-1 blockade and we saw better responses. In patients, unfortunately, when you start to, you know, look at those combinations, the population that you can capture is very immune compromised because they have seen many lines of therapy. So we will never know if little activity is because of real failure of the drug or the fact that the patients are not the right population to treat with those agents. So this is why I think that if it becomes a bit safer in certain indications where you do not have other alternatives to move these drugs earlier on, for example, in neoadjuvant, so where you have an opportunity to remove that tumor anyway. And so you can study how, before removal, you can make memory responses against that tumor. And of course, that memory response will result in protection from metastasis. So I do feel that that is a safer window where we could perhaps understand better how to, you know, induce memory T cell responses against cancer.
It's a huge, it's a huge challenge, but moving things to earlier lines of therapy when, you know, when the immune system's still intact, this is going to be an essential advance. And it's also the kind of the hope of what we're doing, right now, that as things move forward, the response will get better, not just not worse. But and so that's a tremendous excitement. So, you know, you've mentioned so many great collaborative efforts, technologies that you've brought in through collaboration. Could you, you know, and you've been part of PiSea for several years now. Could you talk a little bit about how the collaborative environment has helped your work and direction?
Yeah, absolutely. I am a very collaborative person and love overall. So I push my people to collaborate. First of all, you learn more from your friends and colleagues. And so, and Parker has been very central in all of these, in this main collaboration that I've been able to build. And also mentorship experiences, right? Because of course, Parker allow me to interact with peers, but also with more senior mentors. And that was really essential. So for example, I collaborate with computational biologists that I met first at Parker retreats or other Parker Bridge Fellow. For example, Alex Wan at UPenn is a friend and collaborator. So we do a lot of work together. And also, you know, I interacted with more senior investigators like Bob Schreiber and Jeff Bluestone on, our favorite suppressive T cells. And I feel that was really a component that pushed my decision to stay in the United States, where I really, over the years, as you said, you know, I started to be embedded in this network starting in 2016, and you really build relationships. And, you know, I used to come back from those retreats and I used to say with my friends, you know, that is really what I want to be. You know, I want to be with these amazing minds and discuss science. That's how I try to incorporate collaborations through Parker and other foundation or organizations into my daily work. And so far, so good, especially, you know, we cannot do science in a bubble. And so for other disciplines, I try to collaborate and, of course, contribute my immunology expertise and learned how to speak with clinicians or physicists or computational biologists. And that's how we grow, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, Cornell is our newest center, the newest Parker Institute Center.
Yes.
So can you maybe talk a little bit about how that center is coming together and how it's the network that's being created, just getting off the ground, is driving collaborative efforts there in New York?
So first of all, it's amazing to be back part of the family after, you know, my connection through my Parker Bridge fellowship and then eventually Cornell became part of Parker again. Perhaps that told me maybe I made the right choice to choose Cornell as my new home for my lab. And yeah, so the center, so is for sure, junior faculty in immunotherapy is fantastic that Cornell now is part of the network. We do see a growing recruitment of junior faculty and more senior faculty in immunology and immunotherapy. So, you know, widening these network of colleagues here is very important because, of course, you can collaborate through PiSea centers and, you know, other institutions, but having a solid home for these kind of conversations on a daily basis is important. And it's great, you know, you met my graduate student in the lab that just got awarded the RISE scholarship, and she will be also connected with you guys. And of course, I am very grateful for the support before directly to me and then also my trainees. And so being connected, of course, is an important part for both collaborations, being having research support and so forth.
It's, you know, it's clear just from talking to you and thankfully meeting your students that mentorship really is an important part of what you do every day. And so what's your best advice for young scientists that are thinking about breaking into immunotherapy?
Yeah, so I would say keep on with your curiosity because that's important, absolutely. and be up to date with the amazing technology that is developing. So, absolutely. You know, the new generation needs to know how to code, needs to know how to use, you know, AlphaFold or protein structure tools that everyone now should be able to use. So I do feel that these needs to become bread and butter for the new generation. But of course, the key ingredient is passion and curiosity. These also, when I interview candidates in my lab, that's the very first things I say. You need to be passionate and curious, because that is something that I cannot teach you. You know, that's I can guide you through the project. I can guide you through, you know, collaboration. But as long as you are passionate about what you do, I also think that it's important that trainees and even more senior postdoc are open with their mentors. You know, I just at CTI. I was a mentor for the spin mentoring event the night before the meeting kicked off. And so my job there was to advise on job search in academia, and my table was full and no one wanted to leave. And I tried to engage with them and just, you know, share the lesson. And I think there are certain elements that are very important and sometimes we miss when we, you know, are in our lab doing experiments. So I think they need to, you know, of course, be open and talk and discuss and think about what they want to become and what they want to research on.
Certainly, it's clear for you that this passion and curiosity are just part of who you are, personality-wise. If you weren't doing scientific research, what is it that you'd be interested in doing outside of this?
I was so close to do something different, but I'm glad I didn't do it, I have to say. But the other things that I tried, that actually I got accepted to the program, but then I went to a different path, was interior designer.
Oh, wow.
So amazing. Again, curiosity. You know, we are scientists, I think they are a little bit artists. At the end, I figured out that I could cultivate my passion for being creative in the scientific field, maybe in a more constructive way.
Amazing. Yes. That's fantastic. Absolutely. So thank you so much, Roberta, and, you know, just for joining me here today. Have a great conversation, sharing your perspective overall. Just wanted to highlight, do you have any upcoming papers that are, you know, that the listeners can get to? Where's the direction of the research going now? Like, what's the hottest new thing?
As I said before, you know, we are very excited about how to perturb the vasculature depending on the tumor metabolic state. And again, this goes back to my... you know, the lesson that I learned and I'm, you know, continuing on, you know, finding biomarkers. And so we do see that, for example, depending on the tumor glycolytic state, we have more deranged vasculature. And so we should give antiangiogenic therapies to the tumors that have highly glycolytic scores, which in turn means having bad vasculature. But there are nuances to it that are just fascinating. Just by perturbing glycolysis in cancer cells, we do see that these cancer cells are becoming, you know, less angiogenetic, but more lymphangiogenetic. And so we don't know the role of lymphatics depending on the tumor metabolic state. So I'm trying to connect really maybe big areas of cancer biology and immunology. And also, so there will be this paper about the connection between tumor metabolism, vasculature, and immune responses, and overcoming resistance to also immune checkpoint blockade. But also spinning off that, we are trying to bring in another component that perhaps by changing the tumor metabolic state, we alter the mesenchymal feature of the tumor. So really linking core cancer biology mechanisms with metabolic fluxes that then impact the microenvironment.
It's amazing.
So I like that direction. So we'll see. We'll see where we go.
Yeah, definitely. It's a great story that truly describes the entire system in that tumor microenvironment. So everyone should definitely keep an eye on the Parker Institute social media. We're definitely going to make sure that gets out there, but also all of the wonderful talks that you have. So thank you so much for joining me. This has been just a wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much, John, for having me.
You've been listening to From Bench to Fireside from the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy, and just heard Dr. Roberta Zappasotti explore how the PiCE network is working to turn all cancers into curable diseases. Through collaboration across our network of world-class research centers, PiCE is helping usher promising new therapies from lab discovery to patient impact. But the journey doesn't stop here. Your contributions power PiSEE's mission by accelerating the bold science that will transform cancer treatment as we know it. Make a donation to PiSEE and help bring cures within reach. Visit www.parkerici.org/donate. I'm Dr. Shane Corcoran. Join us next time on From Bench to Fireside.